Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours.
This is Protecting Project Pulp, episode 107. I'm your host, Simon Hildebrandt. Welcome to the show. This week we bring you Dragon's Tongue, the concluding part of Sex Slaves of the Dragon Tongue by F. Paul Wilson, narrated by James Silverstein. If you haven't already, I'd strongly recommend listening to the introduction of episode 105. It contains the biographical information regarding this episode, and more importantly, the foreword that accompanied this story during its publication, which helps to provide context for this modern homage to a period with very different attitudes to race. With that out of the way, let's jump straight in. This is Dragon's Tongue, part 3 of Sex Slaves of the Dragon Tongue by F. Paul Wilson, narrated by James Silverstein.
"He's here," I said, dropping into the chair opposite the old man's desk. Morning sunlight, what little could filter through the thick fog, lit the window behind him. The old man had his jacket off and sat in his shirt sleeves. He looked around. "Where?" "In town." "Swell." "Mind telling me who?" "That Lord of Strange Death's character." "Lord of Strange..." The old man leaned back, hooked his thumbs in his suspenders, and stared at me. "You been drinking?" "Hell no. At least not yet." "The sun out there in Arizona fried your brain, then?" "I'd been stinging after letting that green cop Brannigan do an end run around me on the Catchmar case. The old man would have dearly loved the publicity that would have come out of one of his guys rescuing those girls, and wasn't happy about me missing out. What can I say? The kid got lucky. So to make nice, I'd agreed to chase down a runaway heiress someplace in the desert, a crummy Phoenix suburb called Scottsdale. The light and air out there had hurt my eyes. Everything so bright and sharp and clear. San Francisco fog could be annoying at times, but it had looked good on my return. I'd just returned. I made sure I wore my hat. Then what in blazes are you talking about? Remember that Limey a couple years back who hired us to find his stolen whatchamacallit? Haven't a clue. Yes, you do, because he paid us 3 times daily rate. Oh, yeah, him. I knew mentioning the triple rate would jog the old man's memory. He didn't forget money. He jabbed a finger my way. And as I recall, he wanted you and only you. I deadpanned it. Yeah, he knew quality. He's dead, as I recall. Yeah, bitten by a puff adder in his London digs. Imagine that. Talk about a freak accident. Accident? A deadly snake somehow makes its way from Africa to a London apartment and kills a guy? I'd call that a strange death, wouldn't you? The old man shifted in his seat. I suppose. And this same Limey who just happened to hire us, me specifically, to hunt down some mystery chink who was known to the other London chinks as the Lord of Strange Deaths. Coincidence? A shrug. Could be. So that was how he was going to play it. The old man had already sniffed out where this was headed, and he didn't like it. 2 years ago, July 9th, 1936 to be exact, we get this telegram from England. Sir Edgar Parker Davies of London wants to hire an American gumshoe to regain a stolen artifact. In some roundabout way, via a niece or something who lived in San Francisco and knew somebody who had success with the agency, he'd heard good things about my work and wanted to hire me at triple the daily rate. The old man and I thought it was some kind of joke at first. London had Scotland Yard and more than its share of private dicks. But he telegraphed the details back to the Limey the next day, and Sir Edgar wired us the money, prepaying for 30 days of my time, plus travel expenses. The old man, of course, was delighted. I jumped a Rattler to New York and then sailed to London. I remembered fantasizing at the time about taking a Zeppelin across, but Sir Edgar's travel allowance wouldn't cover the cost of that. Too bad. The Hindenburg blow the following year canceled all Zeppelin traffic, so I missed my chance for good. a long trip, and all the time I was wondering, why an American detective? And of all American detectives, why me? When I finally met Sir Edgar, all walrus mustache and funny accent, in his overstuffed apartment, he offered a number of reasons. The first was my success rate. He'd checked up on me and found that only rarely did I fail to deliver. But so what? I told him I was sure plenty of limey private gumshoes had a similar clearance rate. He agreed, but none of them had wanted to take on the case, because it involved some mysterious chink in the Limehouse district, a guy with no known name, but referred to by the coolies as the Lord of Strange Deaths. And Sir Edgar couldn't go to the police, because the artifact didn't legally belong to him. Seems he lifted it off someone when he and his fellow Brits left Shanghai earlier in the year as hostilities heated up between the chinks and the Japs. What was this precious artifact? He showed me a photo he'd made, a small stoppered jar of nephritic jade, carved into the shape of a dragon claw. Valuable in and of itself for the workmanship, but priceless because of what it contained. Powdered dragon tongue. I couldn't help it. I laughed in his face. It didn't bother him. He seemed to be expecting it. He told me he'd come to appreciate the ancient ways of China while stationed there with the diplomatic corps. He said, pointedly, that most Westerners were ignorant of Oriental cultures and therefore couldn't appreciate them. Yeah, but powdered dragon tongue? I said I didn't have to appreciate anything. If he wanted his little jade jar back, I'd do my best to find it for him. All he had to do was point me towards this Limehouse place and I'd get started. But no, I wouldn't be going to Limehouse. I'd be sailing back to New York. He'd learned through a source in the Chinese embassy that word on the streets of the Limehouse was that the Lord of Strange Deaths had departed for America. For New York, to be specific. If Sir Edgar had been able to notify me before setting sail, he would have, but he only learned it 2 days ago. Frankly, I was relieved. The agency had a New York office, we didn't call ourselves Continental for nothing, with lots of contacts, and I'd be lots more at home dealing with American cops than London bobbies. I headed back on the next ship out, but when I docked and checked in with the New York office, I learned that Sir Edgar was dead and I should return to San Francisco. But I didn't go right away. I did a little sniffing around and turned up a shady chink known as Shiwan Khan. I thought he might be the new identity taken on by the Lord of Strange Deaths, but no. Talking to some local coolies, I gathered this guy was something of an amateur compared to the one I was seeking. Besides, he'd run up against some kook in a cape and a slouch hat and hadn't come out so well. So I trained back and tried to forget about Sir Edgar and his powdered dragon tongue. Did a pretty good job until today. Why this trip down memory lane? The old man said. You know Hank Sorensen? The flatfoot on the Chinatown squad? Heard he was sick. So did I. Figured it was the flu or something like that. Then I'm having coffee with a Potero door shaker and he tells me Sorensen's sick from the bite of a giant millipede found only in the jungles of Borneo or someplace like that. So? Still playing dumb. So Sorensen almost died, might still die, and wouldn't you call that a strange death? The old man made a sour face. I see where you're going, but Borneo's a long way from Africa where the Limey's puff adder came from. Yeah, but they both ended up a long, long ways from where they started. Word is Sorensen was trying to put the bite on a mysterious chink big shot on his beat when something put the bite on him. Let me guess. This Chinatown big shot is known to the locals as the Lord of Strange Deaths. As a matter of fact, no. He's known as the Mandarin. Well, there you go. Now, I'm going to take a couple of days to look into it. Not on the agency's time, you're not. Yes, I am. By my calculation, we still owe the Limey about 10 days. The old man reddened. He wasn't liking this at all. What in blazes are you talking about? Sir Edgar prepaid 30. I spent 8 days getting there, 8 days getting back, and wasted 4 more in Manhattan on that Shiwan Khan deadhead. That still leaves 10 in the till. He's not a client anymore. He's dead. Case closed. And more important, account closed. No, I said, shaking my head. not closed. Not by a long shot. Don't buck me on this. I won't be spending 10 days on it, nothing near that. But whatever time I do spend has already been paid for. So where's your beef? We owe it to the guy. The old man tapped his pencil on the desk as he stared at me. We owe it to the guy? Don't come at me with that. Who do you think you're kidding? I've seen you pad your expenses with the best of them. He leaned forward. The client's dead. It's off our books. It's a closed case. Not for me. That's it, isn't it? This isn't about the limey, it's about you. What do? Keep a private score? I rose from the chair and headed for the door. I'll file reports as usual. See that you do. A private score. The old bastard had hit the bullseye on that one. I'd never got close to the Lord of Strange Deaths, not even within shouting distance, and it had been eating my gut for 2 years. This might all lead to nothing. If so, be it. But if this Mandarin character and the Lord of Strange Deaths were the same lug, I wanted to know. And then there was that matter of a little jade jar. I got hold of Detective Sergeant Hank Sorensen's phone number through the Chinatown Squad's station house and called him. We go back a little. I said I'd buy him lunch in exchange for a little talk. He was fine with that, then rattled a harsh laugh and added, "Long as it ain't Chinese." So we agreed to meet for guinea food at Luigi's on Columbus Avenue in North Beach. On the way over, the fog lifted enough for a glimpse of the Coit Tower on Telegraph Hill. Hard to believe it had been there for 5 years already. I walked into Luigi's and got slammed with a shock. Hank Sorensen looked like death warmed over, and not very well warmed over at that. Sunken cheeks, deeper sunken eyes, skin the color of dumpling dough. The cop must have lost 50 pounds since I'd last seen him. I acted like everything was okay and ordered the veal rollatini. Sorensen chose the linguine and white clam sauce. After the waiter was gone, Sorensen gestured around the restaurant. "What's this about? You thinking of placing a bet so you're checking me out?" I looked at him. "Bet on what?" "Don't tell me you don't know." "Haven't the faintest. Been out of town." And that was the truth. "Then why the lunch?" "I heard you had a run-in with a lug I might be interested in."
"Yeah?"
"The Mandarin." He was reaching for the bread and his hand froze halfway there. It started to shake, and the shake traveled up his arm and passed through his body as a head-to-toe shudder.
"Let's talk about something else," he said in a whisper.
"Just a few questions.
He'll hear about it. He'll know what we say."
His gaze darted right, then left.
"He has eyes and ears everywhere."
I doubted that. Maybe in Chinatown. This was Little Italy.
"He's why I'm like this," he added.
"I heard about the millipede. The poison did this to you?"
"Poison."
He barked that same rattle laugh I'd heard on the phone.
"If only."
He pulled back a sleeve, revealing a skeletal arm, and checked his watch.
"Which reminds me."
He pulled out a cigarette case, opened it, and removed what looked like a red cigarette, but the paper was twisted closed at both ends. He held it up to his mouth with both hands, snapped it open, and inhaled the fine gray powder within. Had the bite turned him into some sort of hophead? "What's that?" I asked. He crumpled the paper and dropped it in the ashtray.
"Medicine."
Sight of his cigarette case started a nicotine itch. I pulled out a pack of Luckies and lit one. I offered, but he shook his head. I set the pack on the table and the lighter atop it.
"Nice lighter," he said.
Its brass finish fit pretty well with the green of the Lucky Strike pack. "Something new under the sun," I said. "It's called a Zippo. Supposed to be windproof, but I haven't tested that yet." Since he didn't want to talk about his condition, I got down to the reason for meeting him. "Tell me what you know about the Mandarin."
"Tell me what you know, and I'll see if I have anything to add."
"All I know is that he runs the crime and vices in Cooley Town."
"Right there, you're wrong. He doesn't run anything. He lets the Tongs and the Triads run the games and the whores and the opium and the protection rackets. He simply sits back and takes a cut."
Must be nice. How does one get in that position?
Anyone who bucks him dies horribly.
What you might call strange deaths? Sorensen nodded.
Very strange.
This was sounding better and better. I could foresee one problem, though. Been here forever, I imagine.
As a matter of fact, no one had heard of him until about 2 years ago, when he blew into town and took over.
Just what I wanted to hear. We waited while the waiter served our meals. The veal smelled great, but it could wait. As soon as we were alone again, I leaned forward. This Mandarin lug, what's he look like? Sorensen poked at his linguine. The clams were lined up along the rim of the plate, shells gaping.
Never saw him.
That didn't fit. But I heard
that I was trying to shake him down. Believe what you like, but I never laid eyes on him. And people who have ain't talking about it. Except for one, maybe.
He had my interest now. Who? His reply was interrupted by a coughing fit. Deep, racking hacks that got the attention of the other lunchers in the place. At least it got some color into his face. After one especially deep hack that seemed to originate in his bunions, something popped out of his mouth and landed on the linguine. It was the same color as his clams, but it was about an inch long and thin. I looked close and noticed it was rimmed with what looked like legs. I leaned back.
Oh, hell!
Sorensen wasn't fazed in the least. In fact, he picked up his butter knife and poked at it.
It's dead, he whispered. Dear God, it's dead!
Let's hope so, I said. He looked up at me, eyes bright, his face showing the first sign of animation since he walked in.
Don't you see what this means? It's dead! That means I'm winning!
You mean before this you've been coughing up live ones? He nodded excitedly.
Yes!
He tossed the dead worm or baby millipede or whatever it was on the floor and dug into his linguine. I looked at my veal and realized I'd lost my appetite. I'm no sensitive houseplant. I've pulled triggers. I've put holes in people. Had a hole or two drilled through me as well, and seen my share of blood and guts, but nothing like this. Give me mayhem any time. I'll take mine home for later. I've got to run. I'll take care of the bill on the way out. Just give me the name of the fellow who saw him.
A green soft heel named Brannigan, Sorensen said. You probably read about him in the Chronicle. That ship that blew up.
Oh, I knew about Brannigan. The cop who saved the girls?
That's the one. He was in the same room as the Mandarin that night.
Then he was the one I needed to talk to. Thanks, I said, rising and going in search of Luigi to settle up. He'd be upset I was leaving my food, but no way around it. I knew I'd be seeing that worm in my dreams. Everybody in town knew about Detective Brad Brannigan. Hard not to after he'd been plastered all over the front of the Chronicle last week. Hero of the waterfront, risking his skin to save all those gals from lives of slavery. That should have been me, or at least us. He could have shared what he knew. But I'm not one to hold a grudge, especially since I probably would have held out on him if our places had been reversed. Earned himself a promotion from Detective 3 to Detective 2. From what I read, sounded like he deserved it. I had a nodding acquaintance with Hanrahan, Brannigan's chief. He told me this was the kid's day off, but gave me his home address in Eureka Valley. No surprise there. An Irish cop and an Irish working-class area. The fog hadn't seeped that far inland, so the sun sat high and bright above Castro Street, where I found him in the shade alongside the big Victorian house where he rented an apartment. He had thick, dark hair, bright blue eyes, and was busy waxing a brand new shark-nosed Graham. I'd seen pictures of the Graham in the papers, but this was my first look in real life. Its model name was the Spirit of Motion. A man could fall in love with a car like that. I mean in real love. A freshly minted detective second grade with a shiny new shark nose meant one thing. He was on the pad. I reintroduced myself.
Yeah, I remember, he said. You looking for another gone gal?
I shook my head. This is something different. I was talking to Sorensen, and he said I should see you.
How's he doing?
He asked.
Looks like one foot in the grave and the other on a banana peel, but he seems to think he's getting better. Well, I hope he makes it, and I hope he learned his lesson. I knew what Brannigan meant, but I couldn't believe he was saying that while he was waxing a newly minted gram. How much do these things run? I asked, hoping he got the point. He shrugged. Don't know. It was a gift. Must be nice to have a rich uncle. He gave me a hard look. It arrived 2 nights ago, fully paid for with all the paperwork. No mention of who from. You must have an idea. Oh yeah, I got an idea, all right. Someone very gratefully got his daughter back in one piece. But I don't know his name, so I can't give it back. He's gonna want something in return. It's known as quid pro quo. At least, that's what the old man calls it. Not this guy. He seemed pretty sure of that. So you figure may as well enjoy it. It's just what I'd do. Damn right. What can I do for you? Hunting a big-shot chink crook. The trail started in London, dried up in New York, but now I think he's landed here. He stopped polishing. The Mandarin. Could be. Well, unless this is really, and I mean really, personal, your life will be simpler and last lots longer if you leave it alone. It's personal enough. Sorensen says you've seen this coolie. Care to give me a description? Brannigan resumed polishing. Tell you what, you give me the description of the guy you're after, and I'll tell you if they're the same. Never laid eyes on him. Then how? We may be talking about different people altogether, but I want to know this mug when I see him. You won't see him. But if you happen across a tall, skinny Chinaman with a high forehead, thinning hair, and, get this, green eyes, you've found him. Green eyes? Never seen a chink with green eyes. Pray you don't see his, because they might be the last thing you'll ever see. You saw him. You look pretty healthy to me. Only by luck. Only because the guy who sent me this car was there. Those eyes. His shoulders gave a quick roll, like he was shaking off a chill. They look right through you. It's like they read your soul. Another shoulder roll. Before he could go all garbo on me, I said, when you were there, did you happen to see a little jade jar carved like a dragon's claw? Something like that was there. I missed it. I was kind of busy staying alive. Fair enough. One last question. Where do I find him? He shook his head. You don't want to. Oh, but I do. He looked me straight in the eyes. So did Sorensen. And look where it got him. I wasn't going to end up like Sorensen, and I wasn't about to let a green cop give me the willies. Come on, my clock's running. Where do you see him? Brannigan hesitated, then said, the Yang Yup Tong house. It's on, I know where it is. But, I waved as I turned away. Thanks. At least I had a starting point. I waited for dark, then headed for Chinatown, a coolly packed square mile or so in the heart of downtown. The fog had thickened to cotton and coated every surface with beads of water, wet enough to warrant a raincoat, which I'd worn, for multiple reasons. I found a darkened doorway off Stockton Street with a view of the headquarters of the Yang Yup Dragon Tong, and eased back into the shadows. The fog had eaten the Tong House's cupola roof, but lanterns and a window or two glowed here and there within its black bulk. Like the other San Francisco Tongs these days, the Dragons tried to keep up a legit front while seeking to maintain the level of influence it had over local vices during the Tong Wars of the 1880s and 90s. All that changed in 1906 when the earthquake and fire razed Chinatown, where everything had been built of tinderwood, to the pavement and below. The Tongs never recovered their former glory, but still wielded considerable power over daily life down here. The '06 quake and fire were sort of like the Great Flood in the Bible. All public records disappeared along with the buildings. Everything had to start again from scratch, including my life. I survived the disaster, but I don't remember a thing about it. I was only 2 at the time and was found wandering the waterfront, scorched but otherwise unhurt. I couldn't tell anyone my name or where I lived. I had no memory of my home or my folks, and had to assume they didn't survive. Like the city, I started again from 0, and my life after that was a series of foster homes. The less said about, the better. I lit a cigarette. I wasn't worried about the smoke or the glowing tip giving me away. Anyone who cared knew where I was. Chinatown was quiet tonight, and this little side street even quieter. The immigration laws had restricted the number of Chinks allowed into the country, and the population had dwindled. I was thinking of making a casual circuit around the Tong House when I heard the slap of slippers approaching along the sidewalk. I pressed back, waiting for whoever it was to pass, but the footsteps stopped. I looked around and saw a Chinese gal staring up at me. She wore a hooded cloak of dark cloth that ran down to her ankles. The light was dim, but I could see she had one of those Oriental faces that are so hard to date. She could have been 30, she could have been 50. Black eyes peered at me through thick horn-rimmed glasses. She sure as hell wasn't a dollar-dollar girl looking for some trade. "What do you want?" I said. She sing-songed her reply through a heavy accent. Her voice was soft, but the words hit like a hard-knuckled punch. "You seek Mandarin? You no find him here." I stared at her in mute shock for a second or two. How the hell could she know that? I shook it off and said, "I'm not looking for anyone, just killing time. Move along." Her black eyes looked me up and down appraisingly. "I know where he is." I bit back a laugh. "And you're gonna tell me, just like that." She shook her head. "Not here." I eased my right hand into the pocket of my raincoat. I'd brought my .38. It didn't take much imagination to see how this was planned to go. She'd lure me into a building or an alley where some of the Mandarin's highbinder hatchet men would reduce me to a bloody jigsaw puzzle and leave the pieces for the coroner to reassemble. "Where, then?"
"You buy me nice dinner, and maybe I tell you."
"Maybe."
"Must see if you are worthy."
I hadn't expected that. Rather than get into her definition of worthy, I remained wary. A little hole-in-the-wall restaurant could serve as a killing floor just as well as an alley. I played along. "I don't know the neighborhood. Where do you suggest?" She made a face.
"Not here. You take me to nice restaurant. I want American food."
Another surprise. "You like steak?" She smiled, and I had to admit she had a lovely smile. Dazzling, in fact. She told me she loved sirloin, but with her accent it came out, "Ruv sirloin." John's Grill down near Market Street on Ellis was less than a mile from where we stood, but a whole universe away from Chinatown. "You're on," I said. I stepped out of the doorway and down to the sidewalk. She was taller than my first impression. We began the short walk over to Powell, where we could catch the cable car down to Ellis. As was the gentlemanly custom, I took curbside to protect the woman from splashes from the street, and to place her between me and whomever might jump from a doorway. Along the way, I kept a tight grip on the .38 in my pocket. John's Grill was one of the first places to open after the fire. It boasted dark oak paneling and damask tablecloths. The conversation level dropped, and I caught a slew of dirty looks from the bar area when I walked in with a chinky girl. The maitre d' acted like we were invisible, even though I saw a fair number of empty tables scattered around the floor.
"Will you take my wrap?" she said.
"Wrap. Listen to this one. Maybe you ought to keep it on. We may not get seated."
"Oh, we get seat."
She turned, flipped back the hood, and shrugged out of the cape. I caught it and folded it over an arm. Not for long, I figured. We'd be back on the street real soon. Then she turned around. If the conversation level had dropped when we stepped in, it fell off a cliff now. She had raven black hair cut in a bob, and her slim body was wrapped in a slinky, high-collared red silk sheath decorated with golden dragons that coiled from her shoulders to her ankles. I turned when I heard the maitre d' clear his throat behind me.
"We can offer you a window table or a corner booth, sir. Which would you prefer?"
"Booth," I said, sounding a tad hoarse. "Definitely a booth." Well, her name was Nu Ying, and she did indeed rub sirloin. I watched her slim ivory hands slice off delicate, bloody rare slices and slide them between her ruby lips. Now that she'd shed the hooded cloak and the light was better, I noticed how pale she was.
just a hint of yellow to her skin. She'd removed her thick lenses to eat, and her eyes looked wider than the average Oriental's. This gal was some sort of Eurasian. After flirting with the idea of a Dungeness platter, I'd settled on a big porterhouse, but I kept finding myself looking at her. She was stunning, but I wasn't about to let that distract me. "So," I said, drawing out the word, "where do I find the Mandarin?" She put down her knife and fork and lifted her wine glass. She'd ordered a Californian red. Californian. Nobody drank Californian wine, even before it'd been shut down by Prohibition. Prohibition had been given the boot only 5 years ago. I'd noticed the label said Inglenook. Who ever heard of naming a wine Inglenook? Me, I always ate steak with a bourbon and a splash. She sipped her wine and leaned forward. Her pale cheeks were flushed. Maybe she wasn't used to wine. I heard Orientals and booze didn't mix well. "You not find him standing outside Yan Yup Tong house, silly man." "He was seen there."
"Do you know anything of Chinatown?"
"A fair amount."
"Have you ever cut open anthill?" "Chinatown like anthill. You have many buildings above, many, many passages below. If Buhu Dao Doi want, he enter Joss house on Pine Street and come out on restaurant in Broadway."
"I thought all those secret passages were destroyed in the earthquake."
"Can rebuild what destroyed."
She waggled a slim, ivory-hued finger at me.
"Round eyes never catch Chinamen in Chinatown. Not without help."
"And you're going to help me?"
"First you tell me why you want Mandarin."
I wanted to be asking the questions. I watched the pupils of her black eyes closely as I said, "Ever hear of the Lord of Strange Deaths?" "No change." She merely shrugged and said, "Of course." "He disappeared from London a couple of years ago. This Mandarin character showed up here about the same time. I'm wondering if they're two of the same. You have any thoughts on that?" A sip. A shrug.
"I only his concubine."
I damn near dropped my fork.
"His concu—"
"Then you must know." She shook her head.
"I with him only 1 year."
I leaned back and gave her a hard stare. This stank of a setup like the wharves in August. As long as I had her here. "First things first. How did you know I was looking for the Mandarin?" Another shrug, another sip.
"I overhear Zhang Jifu tell him man asking cops about Mandarin."
Before I could ask how he could know, she said,
"Mandarin keep an eye and ear on Detective Sorensen."
I could imagine why, waiting for the millipede bite to take its ultimate toll. And I'd have gone and had a public conversation with Sorensen. Well, even a private talk might have been overheard. "You're his concubine, you say? That's some sort of sex slave, isn't it?"
"Sex?"
Her laugh was musical. I know people call laughs musical, but this one had a genuinely tinkly sound to it.
"He not touch Nu Ying, ever. He only look."
I wasn't following. "You mean he watches you have sex with someone else?" That laugh again.
"Silly man. He not interested in sex. I pose. He look."
These Orientals were strange, strange, strange. "Pose how?"
"After dinner, we go to your place. I show."
What was that? She'd been sent to find where I live? "It's a long way from here," I told her. She frowned.
"No, it not. It on Ivy Street."
I squeezed the handle of my steak knife. "How did you know that?"
"Zhang Jifu, tell master."
All right, enough of this. And I'm supposed to believe the Mandarin just lets his concubine out to wander the streets and pick up gumshoes for a meal?
"He leave town 2 day. I bored. I try dim sum. Like steak. Like wine. You eat. We go. I show you pose."
Maybe it was her laugh. Maybe it was the whiskey. Whatever the reason, we wound up at my place, and we were both a little tipsy. She more than I. After all, she was a slip of a thing, and she'd downed that whole bottle of wine. After I hung up her cloak, I went to the cabinet where I kept a bottle of Beam. "I don't have wine," I told her, "but I do have..." I turned and froze. All her clothing lay in a pile on the floor. She stood there in her birthday suit, balanced on her left foot, her right arm and leg stretched behind her, her left arm pointing ahead. She had small, sleek breasts, and not a hair on her body. "This what I do for master?" I couldn't speak. With her white skin, she looked like a statue, literally, for she posed statue still. Not a waver, not a tremor, despite the awkward pose. She said, "Then he point, and I move." In a fluid motion, she assumed a new stance, equally graceful. "Sometimes I hold hours." My gaze traveled the lines of her alabaster body. She was exquisite. "I taught thousand ways to please man flesh, yet this all master want." She dropped the pose and glided towards me. She placed her hands against my chest. "I need show man what I know. You be that man?" I still couldn't speak, but I could nod. In my business, you deal in facts. Fact, I am thick and on the short side, not the sort women gravitate to. Fact, she was not attracted to me. Fact, she'd had a lot to drink and needed a man. Fact, I was handy. Fact, I have never experienced anything like that before or since. A thousand ways to please man flesh. She needed only a few to leave me weak and exhausted. I awoke at sunup because I always awaken at sunup. I was facing the wall. I remembered last night, and first the thought had been one hell of a dream. And then I heard her sobbing. I rolled over and found her sitting on the edge of the bed, her bare back to me. "What's wrong?"
"I will be punished," she said without turning. "Staff tell master when he return."
I didn't like the sound of that, not one bit. "Punished how?"
"He have many way. Way that leave no mark."
"No, he wouldn't want to mar that perfect skin." "Then don't go back."
"I must. If master have to look for Nu Ying, he punish worse."
She glanced at me over her shoulder.
"No can stay here. He know about you."
As enticing as it was to think every night could be like last night, I hadn't been considering an invitation. I was glad she'd taken it off the table. "Can you get out of town?" She shook her head.
"I have no money."
"Neither do I," I said quickly. I felt like an overwhelmed spring. I couldn't get a bead on this whole situation. I'd spent the night with a beautiful expert in the sexual arts. I'm no patsy. I've investigated too many cons and hustles to know that a thing that seems too good to be true usually is. I'd been around too long to believe that this was just what it appeared to be. So what was it? A shakedown? A trap? When would I find some hideous poison thing in my bed? Then, in a barely audible voice, she said,
"I know where master keep money."
And everything fell into place. I let out a sigh of relief and felt my tight muscles relax. Quid pro quo. That I understood. I'd enjoyed the quid. Now I'd be expected to provide the quo. I decided to play along. Where would that be?
"In wall behind hanging. He think I not know, but I see. He keep key all the time."
She sniffled and gave me another teary look over her shoulder.
"You know how to open lock?"
"Oh, yeah. I can pick a lock with the best of them. How much money are we talking about here?" She turned. Her small brown nipples jutted towards me.
"No dollar bill. Gold and jewel."
A little chime sounded in my brain. A place where the Mandarin stored his valuables. Might those valuables include... jade, too? She shrugged.
"Jade, yes, much jade, but jade not worth like gold and diamond."
A certain piece was worth it to me. I lifted the covers. "Get back under here, and we'll figure out a way to get into your master's hidey hole. But first, now that I knew how to supply the quo, I figured I deserved a little more quid." I like to keep things simple, and the plan we cooked up fit the bill. The Mandarin was scheduled to return tomorrow. Niu Ying knew only that he and his minion Zhang Jifu had gone off to finalize a purchase from someone she'd heard mentioned as Oliver. She didn't know when he'd return tomorrow, so that gave us today. After my second helping of quid, I was, I admit it, weak-kneed until I'd gotten some coffee and eggs. I ate alone as Niu Ying returned to the Mandarin's palace. She'd given me the address, a place on Stone Street near the Chinese hospital on Jackson. I was to meet her there at 12:30 sharp. I headed for the agency. I said hello to Effie as she stepped outside of the Spade and Archer office down the hall from ours, but she barely acknowledged my existence. I was used to that. Discretion being the better part of valor, I avoided the old man. He'd be asking questions and wouldn't like the answers. I closed myself off in a cubicle and practiced with my rakes and tension bars. They say lockpicking is like riding a bike, and in a way it is. Once you've got used to feeling those pins fall into place in the cylinder turn, you can always go back to it. But I hadn't done it in a while, and I wanted a little honing. I wanted to get in and out of the Mandarin's lair as quickly as possible. Niu Ying had no idea what kind of lock it was, so I had to be ready for anything. She said it had a key, so that was the important thing. A combination lock was beyond me. At 12:30 sharp, I knocked on the front door of a very ordinary-looking brick building. Niu Ying, wearing a black tunic and loose black pants, let me in. She carried a drawstring purse, and her expression was strained.
"Must hurry. Master change plan. Come home today."
"Today?" I didn't like that. This was supposed to be a simple snatch and run.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"How?" Good question. She had no way of reaching me. Even if she'd had my home number, I hadn't been there all day. "Move," I said. We had to squeeze the minutes. She led me through a succession of plainly furnished rooms. Oriental furniture, to be sure, but nothing fancy. Towards the rear of the house. Not at all what I'd expected for the overlord of Chinatown's crime. And where were his minions? "Aren't there any?" I began as we passed the kitchen. Half a dozen people laid sprawled on the floor, or slumped across a food-littered table.
"I drug tea," she said. "They sleep hours."
That answered that question, but I still wondered. I expected more lavish surroundings.
"Master not care for comfort."
I knew the type. Power fueled their engine. This Mandarin was skimming 10% of Chinatown's vice take and sitting on second-hand furniture. The money didn't go on his walls or on his back or into his belly. It bought influence in high places. Power. But I still didn't know if the coolie who lived here and the Lord of Strange Deaths were one and the same. I hoped his treasure cabinet held the answers. Then I'd be settled straight with the late Sir Edgar, and I could send Niu Ying on her way to a place where she'd never have to pose naked for some yellow pervert again. She led me upstairs to a second-floor room where all four walls were hung with elaborate oriental rugs. At last, a show of extravagance. I noticed a brown-skinned figure lying face down in a corner. I'd expected the place to be guarded by hatchet-wielding black pajamas Buhao Dodois. This one wore only a white loincloth. "Who's that?"
"One of Master's dacoits, come all the way from Burma. He sleep now."
The wall rugs covered the windows, so the room was lit by electric sconces between the hangings. A curved chair with a high back sat on a low dais against the wall.
"This where Master hold meeting," Niu Ying said.
"Where's the cabinet?" She grabbed the edge of one of the hangings and pulled. It slid sideways on a track to reveal a steel door set into the wall. The cabinet itself was no doubt bolted to the support beams of the wall. An ornate red and yellow lacquered dragon had been carved into the steel. What was it with these coolies and dragons? No knob or handle on the door. Just indented groove for fingertips. And just above the groove, the lock. I didn't see the name of the maker or locksmith anywhere. No matter. I knew the lock had to be fairly new. This particular building was maybe 15 years old. Someone had learned a lesson from the quake and fire and built it with brick, and so the safe couldn't be any older. I went to work with Niu Ying pacing behind me, wringing her empty purse in her delicate hands. "Nervous?" I said as I inserted a tension bar into the keyhole.
"Yes, if Master catch me..."
She didn't need to finish. "I'll see that he doesn't." The pins didn't respond to the first two rakes, but the third began getting results.
almost there.
I hear the car, she said.
I glanced over my shoulder as she moved to one of the drapes on the far side of the room. She lifted it a few inches and peeked out.
Not for this building,
she said. Keep watch. I'll just be... I felt the last pin drop and the cylinder rotate a couple of degrees. A little voice was sounding in the back of my brain saying this was way too easy. Well, it was and it wasn't. I had inside help, otherwise I wouldn't have known about the cabinet or even the house. The place had been guarded, but again, my inside help had doped all the troops. I dropped the rake and slipped my fingertips into the groove. The bolt inside was heavy, and I didn't want the short end of my tension rod breaking off in the keyhole. No one would be able to open it then. The door had minimal give, but I wiggled it best I could as I levered the little rod. The cylinder turned slowly, slowly, until the bolt suddenly snapped back. The door must have been perfectly balanced on its hinges because it swung open with an ease that took me by surprise. I stumbled back. And good thing, too. Something hissed, and a long olive-colored snake shot from the cabinet. I had a glimpse of the black insides of its open mouth, its extended fangs. Nuying screamed and did a little dance as it wriggled its 8-foot body across the floor and disappeared behind the lower end of one of the hangings. You didn't tell me there was a snake in there.
Never was, she cried, eyes wide. Master must have put one leave.
Looking on the inside of the door now, I saw air holes, camouflaged by the dragon carved into the outer surface. Well, I'd thought it was too easy. The snake changed my mind. I'd done a little research on the thing after Sir Edgar's death. By all the descriptions I read, that was a black mamba, the black referring not to its skin color but to the inside of its mouth. Deadliest snake in Africa when provoked, but shy by nature. It would stay put behind that rug as long as we didn't bother it, and we weren't going to do that.
Hi.
Nuying looked stricken as she approached the open cabinet.
Where gold? Where jewel?
I saw what she meant. Only a few gold objects on the shelf, looking lost and lonely. But I noticed something green off to the side and caught my breath when I recognized Sir Edgar's dragon claw jar. I grabbed it and worked the tight stopper free. Gray powder like ash filled the inside. Powdered dragon tongue. Sure. If you believe that, I had a big rust-colored bridge I could sell you. As I restoppered the bottle, Nuying said,
What you have? Is that not worth? How am I escape?
This is for me. You can have the rest.
Not enough.
She looked ready to cry as she loosened the drawstrings on her purse. I began sweeping anything that looked valuable off the shelves and stuffing it into the purse. It'll get you a start. I knew a jeweler who'd give her a good price on my say-so and have the gold melted down and the stones reset before I put her on a train out of town. Car door slammed outside. This time I heard it, too. Keeping my distance from the spot where I'd last seen the snake, I hurried across the room and lifted one of the drapes. A black-robed coolie was opening the rear door of a sedan. A taller chink with a skull cap and thinning hair got out. I ducked back and tripped over the prone dacoit. My hand touched his back. Cold. He felt dead. I threw Nuying a questioning look, but her features had gone slack with terror.
Him? She whispered.
I'm assuming yes. There a back way out? She didn't say anything. She simply ran. I followed her downstairs to the ground floor, past the kitchen littered with still forms. Were they dead too? Had she miscalculated the dose of whatever drug she'd used and overdosed them all? I'd worry about that later. Down another set of steps to a damp cellar. She tore aside the tapestry to reveal a door in the wall. She pulled it open and hesitated. Darkness awaited. Where's this take us?
Many places.
The famous Chinatown underground. We didn't have time to wait, and any place was better than here. Someone had to take the lead, so I ducked past her. I didn't have a flashlight, but I had my Zippo. I hoped it was windproof like they said, because I intended to be moving as fast as I could. When Nuying closed the door behind us, I lost all bearings. I spun the wheel on the lighter and a flame appeared. I held it straight out before me and started moving. It threw a little light, but it was better than nothing. We'd gone about 20 feet when something sharp pricked the back of my neck. I slapped the spot but found nothing. Had something bitten me?
10 paces or so later, my legs began to feel wobbly. Another 3 or 4, and they gave out. I landed on my knees and pitched forward. I was able to break my fall with my arms, but an instant later, they were useless. The Zippo skidded away ahead of me. "No, Ying." I felt a hand in my jacket pocket. Sir Edgar's jade. I tried to stop her, but I couldn't even speak now. She wrestled the jar free. Something dropped by my face. Metal clinked within. Her purse with the gold. Didn't she want it? I saw her pick up the lighter and hurry away down the black passage. The faint glow became fainter. I heard a high-pitched yelp of either shock or terror. And then the darkness became complete. The first thing I became aware of was the rocking. Next was the cold steel floor against my cheek. I lift my aching head and open my eyes. Details slowly registered as my vision cleared. A single bulb swaying on a cord overhead, oblong wooden crates stacked on all sides. Nu Ying sitting cross-legged on the floor a dozen feet away. "You," I said, fighting nausea and vertigo as I pushed myself halfway up to a sitting position. She stared through me, saying nothing, not even acknowledging my presence. And as she stared, I noticed something. Her eyes were green now. I felt something around my neck, a steel collar with a chain running to a ring on the floor. I noticed a similar collar encircling Nu Ying's throat. "Where are we?" Again, no responses. I weathered more vertigo as I struggled to my feet. When the world steadied again, I looked around. I had enough chain to stand, and that was it. Not enough to reach Nu Ying. If I had allowed that, I might have strangled her. Obviously, we were in the hold of some sort of cargo ship. The sway of the floor and the vibrations running through it told me we were underway. But what was the cargo? A stack of crates sat close behind me. I examined the nearest in the dim light. They were nailed shut, but I could read the stenciling along the top. Springfield Armory, M1903. Add that to the length of the crates, and these had to be Springfield M1903 rifles. I looked around at all the crates. There had to be hundreds, no, thousands of them in the hold. I turned to Nu Ying. "What's going on here?" Again, nothing. "What did you do to me?"
"She poison and betray you," said a soft voice from above.
I looked up and saw a tall, thin, high-shouldered Chinaman in a floor-length robe of embroidered yellow silk standing on an overhead gangway. Thin black hair flowed from under a brimless beaded cap. Beneath that, a high, domed forehead arched to a pair of light green eyes. The eyes identified him, the criminal overlord known as the Mandarin. And because of the contents of his cabinet, I now knew he was also called the Lord of Strange Deaths. He turned his emerald gaze on Nu Ying.
"You are an expert in that, are you not? Follow Sui?"
He hissed the S softly. I turned to her as well. "Is that your real name? I guess I shouldn't be surprised." Still, she didn't react. The Mandarin said,
"She has gone by many names. Madame Ingomar, Queen Mamaloy, Ling Moy, Lin Tang. What was it this time, my dear?"
Since she wasn't speaking, I answered for her. "Nu Ying. I suppose that it's easier to pronounce than Falo Sui."
"Oh, she would never use Falo Sui. That is merely a term of endearment for my daughter."
I felt as though I'd been punched, but looking at her eyes now, I couldn't deny the truth. "Daughter, she said she was your concubine." A soft laugh.
"Did she now? Such an imagination."
"But her eyes were black."
"Scleral lenses. Not terribly new. Used to improve vision, but tinted ones can change eye color."
He smiled.
"Did she adequately demonstrate to you the talents of a skilled concubine?"
Now it was my turn to keep silent. The gal had played me like a maestro. She'd softened me up with sex and told me just enough of what I wanted to hear, and then let me fill in the blanks the way I wanted them filled. Finally, when I could look at her again, I said, "Why?" I gestured around at the crates. "Was it all about these?"
"All about them and nothing about them," the Mandarin said. "Isn't that right, Fa Lo Sui?"
She still refused to speak or even look at her father.
"This model is being replaced with a newer design, so a man who was once an enemy got me a good deal, as you people say."
"What are you going to do?" I asked him. "Start a war?"
"End one, I hope. As for my daughter's scheme, I have a good idea as to her purpose, but I shall let her tell us herself."
Now she reacted, leaping to her feet and crying,
"No, not that!" He clapped his hands once and said, "Zhang Jifu will do the honors."
The daughter's voice rose in a scream.
"No!"
Was he going to torture her? His own daughter? A black pajama chink appeared from nowhere, carrying not instruments of torture, but a small jade jar shaped like a dragon's claw.
"Sir Edgar's," I said.
"No," said the Mandarin.
"Mine."
The one called Zhang Jifu placed the jar on one of the crates and removed the top. He dipped a finger in the powder and then approached the daughter. I didn't even know what to call her. She whimpered and cringed away, straining at the chain that bound her to the floor. She wailed as Zhang Jifu pounced on her like a cat, yanked her head back, and rubbed his finger inside her cheek. He released her, and immediately she began spitting out whatever he dosed her with. He paid her no mind as he returned to the jade jar, stoppered it, and faded again into the shadows.
"Powdered dragon tongue," I said. "What is it really? A poison?"
"In a way, most certainly."
Which meant he'd just poisoned his own daughter.
He stood watching her from on high as she tried to spit out every last speck of what had been forced into her mouth. After a moment or two of this, he spoke.
"Tell us, Fa Lo Sui, what was your plan?"
She clenched her jaw and clasped both hands over her mouth. Her face turned red as she held her breath, but finally her hands dropped to her sides and she began to speak.
"To use the dragon tongue to make you discredit yourself before the Sifan Council."
"For what purpose?"
"So that you would lose your position and I would ascend to it."
I noticed with a start she'd lost her accent. Her English was perfect.
"What's this mean?" I blurted. "What's happening?"
Her eyes blazed at me, yet she answered calmly in an almost matter-of-fact tone.
"The Sifan is a global organization that influences world events. My father holds high rank, but he has been diverting funds that should be flowing into the Sifan's coffer to a more personal concern, to fight the Japanese invaders in our homeland. I plan to slip some dragon tongue into his tea before the meeting so that he would admit his treachery himself."
I looked up at the Mandarin.
"But you said it was poison."
He nodded.
"The most dangerous poison of all. Truth. One cannot deceive under the influence of dragon tongue."
I turned to her. "Why me?"
"Isn't it obvious, you oaf? You call yourself a detective. You went to Sorensen."
"Ah, yes," the Mandarin said, raising a hand.
"Detective Sorensen. He is no longer with us."
I groaned. "He thought he was going to make it."
"An error in judgment. One of many on the detective's part. But his travails helped pay for this cargo."
The daughter said, "He made his errors, just as you made more than your share. You went to Sorensen, then went to Brannigan, where you mentioned the jade container of Dragon's Tongue. I had been looking for a way to get my hands on that jar. You were perfect. Putty in my hands, so superior to the coolies, the great white hero coming to the chinky girl's rescue while using her for his own ends. After you opened the cabinet, I was going to leave you to take the blame for the deaths of the staff and the attempted robbery."
"Attempted? Of course. I needed less than a thimble's worth of the powder for my needs. My father wouldn't realize a little was missing, but his early return ruined everything."
She was right. I'd acted the fool, and now I felt like one. All my years of experience, and I let myself get played like a greenie. But I kept that hidden as I shook my head and stared at her. What kind of daughter betrays her own father like that?
My question must have triggered something because she launched into a tirade about how she'd never been allowed to see her mother, how she'd been ignored by a father whose life was filled with more important things than his daughter, who'd left her to be raised by a progression of strangers and then sent off to a succession of boarding schools. Betray her father? Why not? She hated him and would do a far better job for the Sea Fan than he. By the end, she'd collapsed to her knees in a sobbing heap. I almost felt sorry for her, but pity never did anyone any good, and frankly, I'd trade her childhood for mine in a heartbeat.
"Do you have children, Detective?"
the Mandarin said. "No."
"Why not?"
I looked up at those green eyes and realized he'd been watching me during his daughter's diatribe, reading me like a book. I couldn't hold his gaze. I looked away. "None of your beeswax." He clapped his hands again.
"Zhang Jifu, give our guest a taste of the dragon's tongue."
My blood went icy and my gut crawled at the thought. I bit back a no. I didn't want to sound like the daughter, whatever her name was. I saw her grinning at me. She said nothing, but her eyes were full of anticipation. "Your turn." No, not my turn. I'd never let this happen. Spotting the powder on this guy Zhang Jifu's fingertip as he approached, I took a boxer's stance. I was still feeling a little slow after being poisoned, but I could handle this coolly. He didn't slow his approach, and I wasn't ready for his first move. Before he got within reach of my fists, his foot lashed out like a snake. I missed a block. He wore only soft slippers, but he felt like he'd driven the end of a 2x4 in my solar plexus. The air rushed out of me and wouldn't come back. As I keeled over on my side, I felt his finger go into my mouth. I tried to bite it, but it was gone before I could react. He wiped it on my shirt, then stepped back and stood with his hands behind him. 3 pair of eyes watched me for a few minutes. Then the Mandarin spoke.
"What is your name, Detective?"
I knew then he backgrounded me. When? When the old man had assigned me to find Margot Katchmeyer a couple of days ago? Or just yesterday when I contacted Sorensen? I tried my damnedest to give him the name on my gumshoe license, but it wouldn't come out, because it wasn't the truth. I couldn't hold back the words. "I don't know." Then the questions began. Before long, he'd filleted my life into twitching slivers. Everything I'd locked away from view, from everyone else's as well as my own, was paraded out for all to see. The nightmare string of foster homes where I'd been mistreated, each one progressively worse than the last. The beatings, the rapes by foster fathers and foster brothers, the humiliations, the helplessness, the deaf ears whenever I complained, the retaliations for complaining. Everything was out there. All the feelings of worthlessness roared back as I relived all the horrors. By the end, I was curled up into a fetal position on the floor, sobbing harder than his daughter had a short while ago.
"Behold, Zhang Jifu, one of those who look down on you, who dismiss you and call you names, who consider themselves lights of civilization in a world of barbarians and lesser beings. Trash. Treat him accordingly."
Zhang Jifu bowed. "Yes, illustrious." I couldn't resist as my hands were tied behind me. The collar was removed from my neck and I was dragged up to the deck. I could see the retreating glow of San Francisco lighting the fog across the water. We were at sea, a mile or two away.
"What are you going to do?" I said as I was shoved against the gunwale.
"As the illustrious one ordered, dispose of trash." "Overboard? But I almost said drown, but I stopped myself. I'd already made a fool of myself. Of course I'd drown, especially with my hands tied behind my back. That was the whole purpose. I felt Zhang Jifu's fingers work at the knots around my wrists.
He freed them.
"What?
You have terrible life. You will die in water, but not without chance."
I realized this was no small gesture. He was going against his master. I looked at him but could read nothing in those black eyes. Before I could thank him, he pushed me.
I tumbled over the gunwale, but managed to straighten my body so I hit feet first. The icy water closed over me. I shuddered and fought my way to the surface, gasping for air as the freighter lumbered on. I wasted no time. I kicked off my shoes and began stroking towards the glow of the city. The frightened little boy part of my brain the dragon tongue had awakened whined that I had no chance. If the cold didn't seize up my muscles, I'd run out of gas before I'd make the dock. I didn't listen. His incessant whining was why I'd locked him away years ago. Sure, my chances were slim, less than slim, but I was going to make it. And then I was going to devote my life to tracking down the Mandarin or the Lord of Strange Deaths or whoever he really was. No doubt he already had a slew of people on his trail. Well, now he had one more. Trash. We'd see about that.
That was Dragon's Tongue, the concluding story of Sex Slaves of the Dragon Tong by F. Paul Wilson, narrated by James Silverstein. Firstly, let's thank James for his excellent reading of this long and involved text. Between the challenging language and the different voices, I think he did a terrific job. We had every confidence in him, though, after his heroic efforts with H.P. Lovecraft's The Rats in the Walls in episode 47, E. Hoffman Price's The Girl from Samarkand in episode 49, and Henry Kuttner's Spawn of Dagon in episode 90. James is a great narrator and a pillar of PPP. As to the stories themselves, well, I'll set my own politically correct squeamishness aside and echo the author's foreword. We shouldn't forget the racism of the past, shouldn't sweep it under the rug and pretend it never existed. If nothing else, we can be grateful that this is no longer the way it is. We'd love to hear your thoughts, though. Leave a comment on our site at protectingprojectpulp.com or join the conversation in the District of Wonders forum, linked from the site menu. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe to the show via iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Just click the subscribe link. Thanks for listening from everyone here at PPP. Our assistant editor, Fred Heimbaugh, our sound engineer, Tom O'Dwyer, our producer, Tony C. Smith, and from me, your host, Simon Hildebrandt. We hope you'll join us next time for episode 108, where we'll bring you Defense Mech by Ray Bradbury, narrated by Fred Heimbaugh. Remember, never cross the Mandarin, and have a great week.
This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.